Good morning. We're in Acts, the 22nd chapter, and we'll begin our study, more closely toward about verse 27. But to get us there, you'll recall that Paul has reached Jerusalem. So as we look at these verses, it happened when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance, and I saw him saying to me, "Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly, because they will not accept your testimony about me." And I said, "Lord, they themselves understand that in one synagogue after another I used to imprison and beat those who believed in you. And when the blood of your witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the coats of those who were slaying him." And he said, "Go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles." You know, as you get to this statement in verse 22, they listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, "Away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live." And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust into the air, these people seemed to have an innate hatred of the Jews, didn't they? A deep prejudice. And they reacted they had, as said Wednesday night when Dale was teaching, you know, they kind of listened politely up to a point. But when the word Gentiles came up, it was a triggering word. In verse 38, well, let me keep going. "And as they were crying out, throwing off their cloaks, tossing off the dust, the commander," in verse 24, "ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting." Against him that way. "But when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, 'Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned?'" Okay, here's Paul. He's explaining the background to his work to them. They hear the word Gentiles. They go into a rage. The commander decides the only way he can find out the truth, since these Jews are acting like bad men or madmen, with deep-seated prejudice against the Gentiles, advocating murder at the moment. He must be frustrated, this commander. All he can hear are the resounding cries of a mob wanting violence to kill one person. When he asks for explanations, Acts the 21st chapter, verse 34, if you read that, you're going to see he's not hearing any clear messages. He's just hearing a crowd. So without getting any good explanation that he can understand, he orders that Paul be scourged. That may be his lie detector test. You know, we have different means and drugs and so on that are used today, but from a different view, perhaps he thought he could force a confession of the full truth from Paul. The implements of scourging were horribly painful. We've talked about this in times past in sermons and lessons, but you'll remember, other than crucifixion, scourging was the most cruel punishment that the Romans used. Four or five thongs were attached to a stout wooden handle, and embedded in those thongs were jagged pieces of bone and metal. When used by very enthusiastic executioner, if you will, the application of those thongs when they went against the human body that was either bent over a post or suspended could rip open the flesh at every lash, exposing muscles even down to the bone. And if he was really enthusiastic, those thongs come around and hit the person on the front side of the body, opening the abdomen or shredding the face. It crippled many people for life. Some died, few survived in their right minds. And as you see there on the slide, Tacitus, the Roman historian, wrote that 7 out of 10 men who were subjected to scourging died, being literally beaten to death. And of the other 3, they would be carried out on a stretcher, and most remained crippled for life. Roman law, though, prohibited the beating or imprisoning of a Roman citizen before giving him a fair trial. So we come to this point, and as you look at it, Paul knows that enough should be enough. What we have here is, he says, is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? This catches the centurion's attention immediately. It was directly contrary to Roman law to bind and scourge a Roman citizen. So in response to Paul's question, the men stopped, knowing it was against the law what they were doing and that they could be punished if they continued. And they could receive a similar punishment to what they were giving the prisoner. So the centurion goes to the commander and tells him what Paul said. Now, just as a note, this is the second time in the book of Acts that Paul mentioned that he's a Roman citizen. The first time was in Acts 16:37 when he was imprisoned in Philippi. A third occasion is going to occur in the 25th chapter, about verse 11, where he appeals to Caesar. If you think about these 3 instances, Paul insists on his rights as a Roman citizen, I don't think not so much about himself as to benefit the cause of Christ, since the Lord's cause would not be helped, but rather hurt by his death. Now, from Philippians 1, we know Paul was ready to die if it is the Lord's will, but I don't think he wanted to just throw his life away. So when we go on and look at what is occurring here, the commander came and said to him, "Tell me, are you a Roman?" And he said, "Yes." And Paul said, "But I was actually born a citizen." Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him, and the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, because he had been put in chains. So to clarify the situation, the commander asked Paul, "Are you a citizen?" Paul says, "Yes." The commander is going to say to him, "I obtained my citizenship through a large sum of money." Paul says, "I was born a citizen." That's a big turn of events, isn't it? When you talk about being born a citizen, Roman citizenship was acquired by being born in Rome or in a Roman colony or by having citizenship bestowed by the government for unusual services rendered. It could also be acquired illegally by bribing the right officials, which is possibly what the commander had done. The fact that Paul was born in Tarsus had not made him a Roman citizen. Tarsus was a free city, but not a Roman colony. Therefore, one of his father or his grandfather, perhaps, had obtained citizenship in some manner that we don't realize. So, as a result of this exchange, what we have happening is the Roman commander and Paul releases Paul from being bound in chains and being prepared for scourging. He remained a prisoner, just one about which the commander did not know what to do. You know, he's kind of at a loss. At the same time, the Roman commander, the centurion, and those involved were concerned about the implications of having chained and almost scourged a Roman citizen. Is it wrong for a Christian to appeal to civil law? No, certainly not. All civil governments are merely God's servants for his saints. Romans 13, 1 through 4 sets forth that government exists because God allows them to do so. Here in Acts 22, Paul knew Roman law and appeals to it as he did in Acts 16. So as we look at this, but on the next day, wishing to know for certain why he had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priest and all the council to assemble and brought Paul down and set him before them. Now let me stop here and switch presentations, because we're going on into the next chapter very quickly. Sir. Some of the commentators, well, first, yes, I would think they would stop immediately and try to seek proof. But some of the commentators say that there is a little piece of something that looks about like my thumb that people could carry with them that was easily portable that they would have on their person that they could use to document their citizenship. If you didn't hear what Dale was saying, Dale asked, well, how do they know that Paul is a Roman citizen? And suggests that since Jerusalem is a large place with a Roman garrison, they would be able to document and obtain the information to justify it, because most prisoners, to avoid scourging, would say whatever it took to avoid the scourging. So here in verse 30, let me just say, the verses of 22 flow naturally into chapter 23. And as we've been studying the book of Acts, we've seen Paul converted, and any dates I use are commentator estimates. If he was converted in the mid-30s, it's thought that these events are occurring in the late 50s. So 25 years have passed since he worked on behalf of those in Jerusalem who wanted the Jews punished, and he was arresting and persecuting the Jews. And during that period of time, we've seen three missionary journeys occur before he reaches Jerusalem. And there are many other events in his life that we've studied, but now he's in Jerusalem. Verse 30 says the Roman commander, Claudius Lysias, realizes he can't keep Paul in custody under Roman law. But he wants to learn why the Jews are making accusations against Paul. So he releases him from his cell in the fortress Antonia. And as Dale showed us earlier, the fortress Antonia was right next to the temple grounds, situated on the northwest corner of the temple. This is a model at the Holy Land Hotel in Jerusalem that gives you some idea of what it might look like. It was connected to the temple. The fortress was connected to the temple by a couple of flights of stairs. And he has Paul released and summoned. In the King James Version says commanded, and the New American Version says ordered the members of the Sanhedrin to assemble. The Greek word translated in this manner means to urge, incite, order, indicates exactly what the man in charge, namely the Roman commander, wants done. Jerusalem was a subject state under Roman control. The only true authority in the country was the Romans. And we perceive that the Sanhedrin understood that, because they did assemble and they did have to go before the Romans. So as we continue in this, he has this assembly of the people together. And Paul, looking intently at the council, said, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." So what happens next. The high priest Ananias commanded those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Again, chapter 23 continues the thoughts of chapter 22. The Sanhedrin Council historically had 71 members composed of priests and scribes and elders equally divided, plus two presiding officers. Standing before the Sanhedrin, which was the supreme judicial body of the Jews, battered and bruised from beating that he received, Acts 21, 30, 32, Paul stands before these men, some of whom may have been involved with the Sanhedrin 20 years, 25 years before, when he was persecuting the church and receiving his authorization and instructions from the Sanhedrin. They're looking at him. Some of them have to recognize him. And with an intent look at all these members, Paul summarizes his life in the very manner that we would want to strive to achieve. He says, "Brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day." That verse is a plea of innocence. Paul has a clear conscience. Won't it be wonderful if all of us can pillow our heads every single night and wake to face each day with the same statement? The bottom line, when we look at the ideal of a conscience, is the conscience has to be trained to do what is right and wrong, and to know what is right and to know what is wrong in order to perform as God would have us do. Paul says his conscience tells him that he's lived uprightly before God all his life and had committed himself into doing so in a manner that his conscience would be his guide. This statement applies to when he stands before when he represented the Sanhedrin and persecuted Christians, and it applies to his life subsequently when he was converted and preached Christ. In verse 2, what we see is the high priest commands those standing beside him to strike him on the mouth. Maybe the high priest Ananias thought Paul was insulting everyone by saying he lived without guilt before God. He can't respond to Paul's comment, so he has him struck both to punish him and silence him, perhaps. But look what happens next. "Then Paul said, 'God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law order me to be struck?' And the bystander said, 'Do you revile God's high priest?' And Paul said, 'I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" Paul's not silenced. He responds by calling Ananias a hypocrite and clearly says that Ananias will be dealt with by God. "God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall." Paul reacted to the injustice of the situation. In Leviticus 19, 15 and 35, the Mosaical law said judgment should be reached fairly in those deciding the case. "You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly. You shall do no wrong in judgment in measurement of weight or capacity." In Hebrews 5, 1 and 2, "For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sins, and he can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness." In this case, Ananias had Paul hit in the mouth. Is this dealing gently with someone? According to Deuteronomy 25, verses 1 and 2, this is inappropriate. If there is a dispute between men and they go to court, the judges decide their case and they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked. Then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall then make him lie down and be beaten in his presence with the number of stripes according to his guilt. This is what should have been happening. A decision on guilt should have been reached first. The guilty is then punished. In other words, the Old Testament justice was the judges were to listen, they were to reach a decision, then they were to punish the guilty. Now, in verse 3, we see Paul ask them, "Do you sit to try me according to the law and in violation of the law have me struck?" We've seen these justices or these judges, what they should do. But notice, they must have already decided Paul is guilty because they start with a punishing action. In the following verses, we will hear Paul's defense and again see that they will argue against him among themselves, trying to decide, well, what did Paul say? What do we think? In verses 4 and 5, the bystanders, though, say, "Do you revile God's high priest?" They respond to Paul's challenge of Ananias by asking, why does he not show more respect to the high priest? Why Paul did not recognize which person was high priest, we don't know. Perhaps for the moment, he did not keep the high priest's position in mind, or he'd been out of Jerusalem so long, he did not know who that person would be. Paul says in verse 5 that, "I was not aware, brethren, that he was high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people." Regardless of the inappropriate actions of Ananias, I believe Paul's comment agrees that you should respect the office that the man held. Any comments through verse 5? In verse 6, "But perceiving that one group were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, Paul began crying out in the council, 'Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, and I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead.' As he said this, there occurred a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, nor an angel, nor a spirit. But the Pharisees acknowledge them all." Remember that even before a fair hearing, the high priest has already had someone strike Paul, an action that was inappropriate according to Deuteronomy 25:1-2. Being an intelligent man, Paul understands these men already have strong feelings against him. So he perceives the Sanhedrin has many Sadducees and Pharisees present. Recognizing an opportunity to save his life when he sees it, Paul raises his voice and is heard over the voices and noise and says, "Brethren, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, and I'm on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." In Philippians 3, Paul proclaimed his heritage, saying he was circumcised the eighth day of the nation of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, as to the law, a Pharisee. While being a Christian, Paul was a Pharisee in terms of how he had been reared and in terms of agreeing with them in the points in which they disagreed with the Sadducees. That is, in believing in the resurrection, in believing in angels, and believing in spirits. He says, before leaving verse 6, notice these words, "I am on trial for the hope and resurrection of the dead." That seems to be the real issue. It's the resurrection of Jesus that proves the superiority of all that Christ taught. And it is this resurrection which Paul says is the true reason for his trial. He will say this again several times before we end our study of the book of Acts. What was the result of Paul's statement in verse 6? Verses 7 and 8 tell us the result of Paul's statement was disagreement arose between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. Paul says in verse 6, they were divided. And the focal point of the disagreement was the Sadducees and the Pharisees differed over whether or not there was a resurrection of man, the existence of spirits and angels, and the immortality of the soul. The Pharisees believe in each of these, whereas the Sadducees deny the resurrection. Said the soul died with the body, and they denied the existence of angels or spirits. So in verse 9, and there occurred a great uproar. And some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly, saying, "We find nothing wrong with this man. Suppose a spirit or an angel has spoken to him." The disagreements become disagreeable very quickly. Verse 9 says, there was an uproar, and some of the scribes of the Pharisaic party stood up and began to argue heatedly. Fortunately for Paul, they find reason to support Paul, and now they declare him innocent, acknowledging that a spirit or an angel may have instructed Paul. Thinking about the nature of people, maybe the Pharisees aren't so much for Paul as they are against the Sadducees. While this is happening, Claudius Lysias knows he can't keep Paul in custody forever. Paul is a Roman citizen, and he can't be held without valid reason. At the moment, Claudius Lysias is, in essence, providing Paul protective custody. So, and as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. Let's see. The Roman commander was concerned that the Jews would attack and kill Paul. So he ordered the troops to save Paul for the second day in a row. And he has them take him back into the fortress Antonia. After that, what happens is, verse 11, but on the night immediately following, the Lord had stood at his side and said, "Take courage, for as you have solemnly witnessed to my cause at Jerusalem, so you must witness at Rome also." Paul had some encouragement, didn't he? After all the uproar, after all the beatings by the Jews, and two nights under Roman guard, verse 11 tells us, that very night the Lord encouraged Paul because he had further use of Paul's service on behalf of him. This is unique. Often we see an angel involved with man. Here it is the Lord who stood at Paul's side. He tells Paul that Paul must witness for Christ in Jerusalem and Rome. Isn't that what we are to do daily? Aren't we to witness for Christ, bearing testimony of him? This also brings to mind about who Paul said supported him. In 2 Timothy 4:16 and 17, it says, "At my first defense, no one supported me, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them. But the Lord stood with me and strengthened me so that through me the proclamation might be fully accomplished and that all the Gentiles might hear, and I was rescued out of the lion's mouth." Twice now, Paul has tried to preach Christ to his own people in Jerusalem. The first time was in Acts 9, 26 through 30, long ago when we studied that. And the second time is here. Consider Paul. He's been held on false charges, beaten by the Jews, removed from the Jews' custody by the Romans, who let him speak to the Jews again, and they riot. Now he's told he must go to Rome. Do you think Paul is all right with this? Of course he is. The Lord is standing with him, and Paul is devoted to doing the Lord's will. Isn't that the way it is for us today? In other words, in some aspects, aren't we like Paul? I think the answer is yes. Hebrews 13:5 says, "Christ will never leave us nor forsake us." That's true for us today, just as it was true for Paul when Christ said he stood with Paul. We can stand against whatever we face. Christ stands with us. Any comments through verse 11? In verses 12 through 14, we read, "When it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul." You know, I will tell you, out of the entire book of Acts, backing away from class for a second, this is one of my favorite passages, because I think that there is some justice here. They bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul." You know, the Jews aren't done causing Paul problems, are they? With an oath, they bind themselves together. A group of Jews that say, "We'll neither eat nor drink until they've killed Paul." 40 men agree to this plot. Whether these men were Sadducees or zealots, or some type of assassin mentioned in Acts 21:28, we don't know. We do know the oath they took says they are serious about killing Paul. Did the Sanhedrin take the oath of these men seriously? Certainly. Verse 14 says a great deal about the integrity and morality of the Jewish leadership. Why do I say this? Simple. Those who had taken an oath to kill Paul felt comfortable coming to the chief priest and elders to tell them what they are about to do. I don't see Josh in here right now, but he might say that's premeditated murder. In verse 15, "Now therefore you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation, and we for our part are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. But the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, and he came and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions to him and said, 'Lead this young man to the commander, for he has something to report to him.'" As I said, the Jews aren't done causing problems, but happily, the conspirators who've asked the Sanhedrin council leaders to be part of the plot to give them some instructions, they asked the council to request the Roman commander to send Paul back to them so they can question him further. They plan to kill Paul as he returns to meet with the council. But happily, there's something happening here. Verse 16 gives us only reference we have to Paul's family in the New Testament. Paul's nephew hears of the plot to ambush Paul and goes to the Roman barracks and tells Paul. After hearing what his nephew says, Paul sends the young man to the commander. Paul acted upon the information, had his nephew represent him. He was not waiting for miraculous intervention, but took advantage of the assistance that the Romans could provide and Claudius Lysias' integrity by seeking his protection. The protection provided by God through Rome is what we call providence, I think. So look at verses 18 and 19. "He took him and led him to the commander and said, 'Paul the prisoner called me to him and asked me to lead this young man to you since he has something to tell you.' The commander took him by the hand and, stepping aside, began to inquire of him privately, 'What is it that you have to report to me?'" The plot's being exposed, isn't it? "And he said, 'The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down tomorrow to the council as though they were going to inquire somewhat more thoroughly about him. So do not listen to them, for more than 40 of them are lying in wait for him, who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they slay him, and now they are ready and waiting for the promise from you.' So the commander let the young man go, instructing him, 'Tell no one that you have notified me of these things.'" The commander takes Paul's nephew aside, listens, believes what the young man has told him, and tells him to tell no one. The commentator McGarvey suggests that Claudius Lysias has three choices, and we'll stop after I list these. He can either, if he wants to please the Jews, all he has to do is let their plot play out. If he wants to impress everyone with the might and power of the Roman Empire, he could send Paul down to meet with the Jews under such a strong and numerous guard that they cannot touch him. If he wants to protect Paul and avoid overtly offending the Jews and bloodshed, he could send Paul away, thereby avoiding conflict. The choice Lysias makes speaks highly of his personal character and integrity. And on Wednesday night, we'll begin at verse 23. Thank you.